Lecture 12, Nietzsche on Freedom, Fate, and Responsibility.
That notion of the Übermensch, and with it the notions of master and slave, raise one of the most perplexing questions about Nietzsche's philosophy and his overall worldview. It has to do with the notion of freedom, which in my first lecture I described as basic to existentialism, and with it the notion of responsibility, also the essence of the no-excuses approach. But Nietzsche's views on these matters are, in fact, quite complex, and in particular, his notion of master and slave morality makes a suggestion that really freedom and responsibility might be beside the point. Let me explain. There's a sense in which, Nietzsche suggests, one is born as a slave. Not necessarily a slave in the political, social sense, of course, but one is born with servile attitudes. One is born as weak. One is born with a relatively low capacity for self-discipline. On the other hand, one might be born a powerful person with great self-discipline, with an important sense of oneself and one's possibilities. And of course, you don't have to look at too many babies to realize that certain kinds of inborn dispositions are there right from the start. And if you look at, for example, your fellows growing up, I know I went to a high school reunion several years ago. One of the interesting things is they're the same people they used to be. They had just grown up as they seemed to have begun. They were just more of the same, in some ways quite literally. The idea is that we are born with a certain personality, with a certain, let's call it a proto-character, and consequently, there's not a whole lot that we can do in terms of changing ourselves, making the kinds of choices that Kierkegaard talks about, exercising the kind of freedom that will become so essential to Sartre's notion of existentialism. To make this point, in his discussion of master-slave morality, Nietzsche makes up an analogy. It's an analogy between birds of prey and lambs. He says that, of course, the lambs, the vulnerable, of course they resent and come to hate the birds of prey. But in the kind of upside-down turning of values that goes on in slave morality, one can imagine the lambs saying, why can't the birds of prey be more like us? Why can't they, in fact, be gentle and not feed on little lambs? But, of course, the point that Nietzsche wants to make with this very biological example is that there's a sense in which one is by nature a bird of prey, or one is by nature a sheep, first a lamb. And if that's so, then we have to ask, what kind of control do we have over our lives? How much are we, in a sense, the victims of fate and the contingencies of our birth, our health, how our mother takes care of herself, and in our childhood, how we are taken care of? There's a notion of fate that plays a very central role in Nietzsche's philosophy. And one can say, first of all, that this is something which, given his admiration of the early Greeks, is going to be very important to him. He talks about the love of fate and takes it as itself a great virtue. But at the same time, when I include Nietzsche in a series of lectures about the existentialist, and in a way include him as an existentialist, obviously what I have in mind is that he does have a keen sense of just those notions which are so central to existentialism, the notion of freedom and responsibility. But one can't overdo it. There's a sense in which the debate between Hegel and Kierkegaard might be viewed in a practical, personal way, as the view of to what extent we are molded, shaped, determined by the larger forces of society and the larger forces of history, what Hegel refers to as spirit, or the world spirit, or Geist. On the other hand, there's Kierkegaard, who says, whatever the world does with us, however it shapes us, the world produced me, Kierkegaard, as a rather neurotic, upset young gentleman. But what I do with that is, in some sense, up to me. And I think that's the way we should understand Nietzsche too. On the one hand, we are all born with certain inborn talents, abilities, capacities, dispositions, personalities. But at the same time, the idea is not to just accept what we are. It is also to make something of ourselves. But of course, what we can make of ourselves is also, to a large part, determined by our times, our upbringing, and so on. I think the key word here, it's a very modern word and unfortunately now much abused, is the notion of self-realization. It can be traced back again to Aristotle. And Aristotle talks, at great length actually, about how a young man must be raised in the right way, taught the rules of his culture, made to exercise the kind of judgment that will allow him to be independent, autonomous, and excellent as an adult. But after this period of education and externally imposed discipline, there's a point at which a person has to realize him or herself and take the talents, the abilities, and turn them into something. With Nietzsche, too, we might find that we do have certain talents, dispositions, but there's nevertheless a sense in which we are then responsible for them. A talent isn't self-realizing. A talent is something that must be realized. If, as a young child, you find, or your parents find, that you have exceptional ability in music, it's not as if, left to yourself and your own devices, that is necessarily going to manifest itself as musical genius. Musical genius, even if it turns out to be something which is inherited or genetic, musical genius is something that must be worked upon, must be cultivated, and that is one's responsibility. The key to much of Nietzsche's philosophy comes, again, from the Greeks, in this case, the Greek playwright-poet Pindar. It's a phrase that goes, "Become who you are." It's an interesting phrase. Very often, parents will say to their adolescent children, supposedly in order to help them, "Just be yourself, dear." And I think the proper response of the adolescent is, "What's that supposed to mean? How is that supposed to help? Who else could I be?" But of course, thinking about it, you realize you could be, or at least try to be, lots of different selves. In fact, just within you, in terms of your inborn talents and abilities, you could push yourself in a number of different directions. One of the hardest decisions that my best students have to make, many of whom are multi-talented in all sorts of disciplines, often very far apart, is they realize they have to choose. They have to pursue one set of talents at the expense of another. Here what we find is that Nietzsche runs again against Aristotle in a very critical way, even though I think the general framework is the same. Aristotle talks about the unity of the virtues. Nietzsche talks about their disunity. In Zarathustra, he discusses how the virtues, in fact, are at war with one another. And any student who has just wrestled through the problem about should I do this, go into business for which I obviously have great talent, or should I go into music for which I have great talent, or any number of other things which are similarly diverse, it's very easy to realize that the kind of choice you make is something which really does determine what, who you're going to be. And it is not simply a tautology that you simply be yourself, but you have to choose, in a way, what you will become. I think in Nietzsche what you get is a juxtaposition of these two different attitudes, so that you get both this sense of fate and the lot you're born with, at the same time this very powerful sense of self-realization. I think one of the reasons why students are so turned on by Nietzsche, generation after generation, is because they see, even if they don't really understand the text, that the basic message is one of self-actualization, turning yourself into something. And while it's true that a lot of student Nietzsche response has to do with just drinking too much and perhaps using some rather foul language, I think what people see when they read him is that he is really urging them to make something of themselves. And I think that's the key notion. But of course, this idea of free choice has been stretched beyond the bounds of plausibility in philosophy. Philosophers, for a long time, certainly through the 18th and 19th century, we're fond of talking about the will, a notion which goes back at least to medieval times. And it means something very variable, actually, in lots of philosophers. But I think the essence of it is that kind of push that we give to ourselves when we decide to do something. So we talk about willpower, where willpower is measured in a way by the amount of resistance we can overcome. It's willpower not to eat that piece of chocolate cake, which looks more delicious to you than anything you've ever seen. But if you have enough willpower, what you do is you push yourself to, in this case, refuse. Or the willpower of an athlete in the midst of a competition, to push him or herself to excesses which they've never realized before. That notion of the inner push raises, of course, all sorts of interesting philosophical questions. Mainly, of course, whether it makes sense to talk about such a thing. The most immediate context for Nietzsche's use of the word will, and as we'll see, he uses it quite often, is his mentor Schopenhauer. And I want to talk about Schopenhauer for a minute because of the philosophical influences on Nietzsche, even including the ancient Greeks, I think is the most powerful. Arthur Schopenhauer is best known as perhaps the crankiest pessimist in the history of philosophy. He, teaching in the early part of the 19th century, rather unsuccessfully, I should add, as a teacher, taught that essentially reality, the world as it is in itself, is really something that we can, contra Kant, experience. It is not a reality behind the appearances, in one sense, that we experience the will in ourselves, and it's will that is reality, will that is the reality in itself. Notice here that I'm using the notion of will in a very odd sense, in one way, because reality, throughout the whole of the Western tradition, as I argued, has this kind of obsession with singularity, with monism. And so when Schopenhauer talks about the will, he's not talking about our individual wills, something that each of us has. He's talking about the will, the reality which underlies all of us and manifests itself simply in each of us. But it is not in any sense our own. Quite the contrary. Whereas other philosophers, notably Kant, had talked about the rational will, the will which is bound by the rules of reason, Schopenhauer makes it very clear that the will has basically its own ideas, that the will is not something which is bound by rationality. It is not, as Hegel would suggest, something with an ultimate purpose, that human history and human life in general, and life in general, in fact, is just a manifestation of the irrational will. And this is perhaps most obvious in us, in a way that we can easily understand, in, for example, our sexuality. You don't have to be an adolescent anymore to remember, or perhaps very short memory, how irrational sexual desire can make you. Going against all social prohibitions, going against moral standards, really, in a sense, out of your mind. Well, there's a sense in which, Schopenhauer tells us, this is the will manifesting itself in us. And to think of it as something that we have individually is really to miss the point. Because while we think about sex as an activity which each of us indulges in for ourselves, for our own pleasure, the truth is that sex has a purpose that has nothing to do with our enjoyment or pleasure. The purpose of the will is to continue the species. And the purpose of continuing the species? Well, simply to continue life. The purpose of continuing life? Well, to tell you the truth, there is no purpose. Schopenhauer gives us this really depressing picture of the life of all creatures, including human beings. He takes, for example, one of those mayflies that appears essentially all at once on a day in spring. There's this feverish mating, and all of the bugs drop dead, but first having given birth to a new generation who will repeat the same ritual next year, and the process will repeat itself over and over again. What's it amount to? Nothing. And here we can see the influence of Schopenhauer on, among other people, on Camus and his notion of Sisyphean futility. There's a sense in which, for Schopenhauer, the will then is something that really is the essential us, but it's not at all individual. And also it gives rise to his pessimism, because after all, if we are not masters of our own fate, if we are essentially thrown about by these forces within us, then what's the point of life? And Schopenhauer's philosophy is, there really isn't one, and the best that a philosopher can do is to try and give us an escape. And Schopenhauer suggests, among other things, Buddhism, and also aesthetic appreciation, as at least temporary ways of getting us out of ourselves, ways of, in a way, rejecting the will and not being the slave of its forces. Now, Nietzsche was very impressed by Schopenhauer when he picked up a book of Schopenhauer's called The World as Will and Representation, when he was a student. But he utterly rejected Schopenhauer's pessimism. And furthermore, as we saw in the first lecture, he also rejected the idea of the will as the thing in itself, because, in Nietzsche's words, there is no thing in itself. And of course, once we get rid of the thing in itself, we get rid of the idea of mere appearance, too. But this has more dramatic manifestations, because it's the idea of the will, in one sense or another, that makes possible the notion of free will. But Nietzsche, and actually Schopenhauer, too, rejects the notion of individual free will. Schopenhauer, because the will is not in any sense each of ours, but something that is much larger than us acting through us. Nietzsche, for a much more sophisticated and subtle reason. Namely, that the notion of free will depends on what he would consider an imaginary or an illusory sense of self. If you think, for example, of Kant, who defended such a notion of free will, it's the idea that we must presuppose that for the purposes of morality, for the purposes of action, we must presuppose that we are not bound by any deterministic principles. Even the laws of nature, in an important sense, are suspended in this conception of ourselves. And Kant rather dramatically, if confusingly, says that the self, as the self of action, as the self of morality, must be conceived of as outside the world of causes. What Nietzsche wants to say is that there can be no such notion of self. The self is always embedded, contextualized. The self is always indistinguishable, in a sense, from the person with his body, the culture, the world, biology, all sorts of natural forces and contingencies. And to pretend that in any sense we can pull away and look at the self as something detached and act as if we are entirely autonomous is illusory. It's imaginary. It just makes no philosophical sense. So on the one hand, Nietzsche wants to reject free will because the self on which the notion of free will depends is an impossible notion of the self. Let's say, not right away, that Nietzsche doesn't reject the notion of the self. Obviously, become who you are presupposes a very dynamic notion of selfhood. But it's not the sort of detached and philosophical self that's talked about in particular by Kant and a great many other philosophers. The other thing to say here is that talk about free will confuses, Nietzsche says, causes and effects. That we talk about our behavior as if, first of all, there is some sort of act of will. That's the cause. And then, as an effect, there is an action. And of course, this is a very common picture. It makes good common sense. And many of the philosophers in the last several hundred years have used it, in fact, as a paradigm of causality. It's how we understand the very notion of causality, that we can cause our bodies, ourselves, to do things. But Nietzsche gives us a very different picture. What is, in fact, this act of will? What is, in fact, the willing that philosophers refer to? There may be actions, certainly you can think of some, in which you make a special effort, in which there actually is some mental commotion that precedes the course of action. But most of the time, we just act. We just do things. And when we act and we do things, because we have, among our other metaphysical prejudices, this idea that every effect must have a cause, we think that because we act, there must be some preceding cause. And where would that cause be? It must be in the mind. And at this point, we start talking, perhaps rather perplexedly, of unconscious causes, or something very much like that. But what Nietzsche suggests is, in a sense, there's just action. That what we do, because we are the kind of creatures we are, is we act, and also because we're the kind of introspective creatures we are, we try to think we must have caused that action through some more or less deliberate mental activity. But Nietzsche wants to say, most of our lives are not so reflective, not so deliberative. And Nietzsche is one of these philosophers who says that consciousness is something that's vastly overrated. He doesn't, as Kierkegaard and Dostoevsky do, treat it as a disease. Nevertheless, he sees that most of our behavior is not conscious, not reflective, not deliberative. We just do it. And we do it because of the kind of creatures we are. First of all, of course, we're biological creatures. And here that sort of image of the lambs and the birds of prey comes back into focus. There's a sense in which what we do as a matter of necessity. To explain our actions is perhaps, first of all, to explain motives, but more importantly, it's to explain it in terms of our habits, our characters, the kinds of creatures we are, and the age-old philosophical routine of trying to justify actions is something Nietzsche simply puts aside. We've spent too much time judging, he says, and we spend too much time justifying. There's a sense in which we do what we do because of what we are, and insofar as we do have control over our actions, it's by way of cultivating a new set of automatic actions, which is what we call our character. When Nietzsche talks about fate, one can think of this, in terms of the ancient Greeks, as a rather crude notion. For example, in Sophocles' great play, Oedipus the King, Oedipus the Tyrant, we have a very clear picture of fate as some sort of mysterious, invisible hand, if you like, which is actually reaching down and intruding on human behavior. Oedipus is told his fate is to marry his mother, kill his father. He takes every possible step to try to avoid this situation, but of course it comes through anyway. And one wants to say, fate is like this invisible hand that makes things happen quite to the contrary of our desires and intentions. One can find such a notion of fate in the Greek traditions, of course, but I think it's a mistake to simply see it as this mysterious force. Rather, looking back to Heraclitus, Nietzsche's favorite Greek philosopher, one might say fate really is character. And so when we talk about fate, what we're often thinking of is not something mysterious outside of us, but rather just the person we have become, and to a large extent, the person we were born to be. Nietzsche says in one of his wonderful little bits of advice in Gay Science, give style to your character. It's a great art. And what he has in mind is that it's true. We are born with a certain character, a certain personality, but nevertheless, what is within our resources is to shape it, cultivate it according to our fashion. This doesn't mean that we have free will in the objectionable sense. What it means is that part of our character itself may well be to make choices and to have the strength to carry them through. But all of this comes back to a notion of fate which is in many ways much more primal. And it doesn't have to do with being born as a particular person with a particular character and so on, as much as it really has to do with just being born, being alive. There's a sense of existence we talked about in Kierkegaard, in which what's important is to be passionately aware of yourself and your possibilities and essentially pick yourself up through your choices and determine whom you're going to be. Well, Nietzsche doesn't have that notion of choice, and he certainly doesn't have that notion of freedom, as we've seen. Nevertheless, that notion of being passionate about one's life, about a very special notion of existence, which is not just going along with the crowd, which is not just existing, but something very special and characterized by passion, is something that's central to his philosophy too. He has an idea. He sometimes calls it his greatest idea, but Nietzsche says that about several of his ideas. It appears in some of his early work, but reoccurs in Zarathustra, in Gay Science, and in some of his late works as well. which has the odd name of the eternal return or eternal recurrence. On the one hand, again, it harks back to ancient times. The very early Greeks had a mythology in which time was circular and repeated itself rather than time, as in the Christian mythology, in which time is a single dimension that goes from the beginning till eternity. One also finds this notion of eternal recurrence in the mythology of the ancient Hindus, who believed that time was like a wheel, and of course, with their doctrine of reincarnation, believed that things happened over and over again. Nietzsche toys with the possibility of a scientific proof of this dramatic image, but ultimately gives it up, never publishes it. What's much more important is to understand it as a kind of test, a test of one's own attitude towards life, a test of one's own ability to really live one's life without the kind of illusions and evasions that give rise to this notion of the otherworldly that he is so bitterly against. The way the test goes is something like this. Imagine, if you had to live your life exactly as you have lived it, not just once, but over and over again. The repetition gives your life a certain kind of weight, gives each moment a certain kind of weight. And it's this notion of weightiness and lightness that Milan Kundera, in his great novel, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, toys with at the beginning of the book. That if something happens just once, we can say, whew, glad that's done with. It's over. But if something is going to repeat itself an infinite number of times, one is much less willing to say, okay, let's do that again. Well, the test is, how much do you love your life? How much are you consumed with regret? It's very important to be able to say, thinking this, as Nietzsche puts it, terrible thought, that one would grasp at this possibility of repeating one's life over and over again with enormous enthusiasm. And it's a sign of something pathetic if your response is, nah, I'd rather not do it at all. One thinks of Camus' character, Meursault, who, when he is in his argument with the chaplain, conceives of the afterlife as nothing other than the repetition of this life, and who thinks of any moment of life as one which one could dwell on infinitely. One thinks, for example, of Kierkegaard's discussion of repetition, which we didn't really discuss, but has as its outcome, trying to turn repetition into a kind of meaning. There's a sense in Nietzsche in which all the questions converge on the question of whether you really accept life itself, and that means your life. We all wish that in some sense things were different. We all wish that we had a different body, a different voice, a different culture. We imagine being born in a different time, in a different century. We imagine being richer than we are, healthier than we are. Nietzsche himself, of course, was a very sickly, even pathetic human being who fought with sleeplessness, horrible headaches, and various illnesses all of his life and died very young. Nevertheless, it's clear that what Nietzsche would reply, or at least what Nietzsche would like to have replied to this thought of eternal recurrence is, how godly, how divine, that's what I want to do, to live my life exactly as it is, an infinite number of times. Now, one can take this in a number of different ways, and I think I've highlighted what is for Nietzsche the most important one. But it also goes back to this question about fate and free will, and the question about how one becomes who one is. Because in a sense, what this test does is it tests how satisfied are you with yourself. But it doesn't have to be totally fatalistic. On the one hand, Nietzsche celebrates what he calls amor fati, the love of life, the love of just being who you are, of having a life. At the same time, it's clear that eternal recurrence has a different implication. Eternal recurrence can be seeing what your life is like, seeing what you really don't like because you're not willing to repeat it, and then changing yourself, cultivating yourself, and becoming not who you simply are, but who you would be. There are all sorts of limits to this, depending on who we are and how we find ourselves and where we fit into our society. But fate here is not blind resignation to what will happen. It's rather acceptance of our limitations, and it's rather trying to make something of ourselves in accordance with who we already could be. Unlike Kierkegaard and Sartre, Nietzsche is quite ambivalent about the notion of responsibility. Nevertheless, I think we'd make a huge mistake if we dismissed the notion of responsibility and responsibility to realize our talents from his philosophy, because after all, that's what it's all about.
I'm Tom Rollins, president of The Teaching Company. We hope you've enjoyed the lectures on these tapes. To order more courses or to receive a copy of our most recent catalog, call 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-TEACH-12. Or visit our website at www.teachco.com. Thank you very much for listening.